Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real.
Awesome. We're live. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the TKS Making It Real podcast. I'm stoked to have you here. Michael and I were in the TKS 2018 cohort. I feel like I say that every time because everyone I'm recording with is in that cohort. Anyway, OG McKinsey days. Michael has been brilliant in bio for the longest time, that like bio, genomics, tech intersection. So I'm stoked to catch up because he's like doing the quintessential bio triangle of Boston, San Diego, and, you know, original Toronto. And so I think there's a lot we're going to learn from him today. But Michael, why don't you give us a bit of a spiel? Who are you? What do you care about? What wakes you up in the morning?
Thanks, Izzy. It's great seeing you again. Yeah. So hey, everybody, I'm a fourth year undergraduate student at the University of Toronto, just wrapping up my undergraduate degree, doing a double major in immunology and genetics. I just came back from a year of like a visiting student term over at MIT, where I was working on molecular engineering and building like basically new genetic engineering tools. And right now I'm currently a research fellow at the Phase Brain Repair Lab at the University of Toronto, where I basically apply a lot of the molecular engineering techniques that I worked on back at MIT on a new type of cell in the brain, like a not really well-known type of cell in the brain called an astrocyte. So really excited to kind of dive in. It's been a crazy journey. And Izzy, thank you for having me on.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. Let's learn about new cells today. I think this is going to be fun.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't we start? You've had a crazy year, crazy 5 years. I mean, that's kind of the timeline we're looking at. What is a mindset that you've been relying on recently?
I think there's definitely one that really comes to mind, which is like, and I think this is kind of goes back to some of the core training that we get in TKS, which is what is a key question that our key assumption that we're all taking for granted for now? When I say we, I mean those of us who are like, you know, trying to like pursue solutions or build cool things in the space. What is a key question that we're just like assuming is true, or something that we're just assuming that we know enough of, something that we're just taking for granted as being true? And I think as a scientist, this is a really important question to ask. And this question is kind of informing how I structure my PhD, actually. So happy to jump into that more.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is epic. We're going to go into that. That's really cool.
Yeah,
good seed to plant. So you're going straight into your PhD after this year.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm applying to PhD this cycle, this application cycle, and hopefully starting in September.
Oh my gosh, that makes me so thrilled. You're going to be like the best PhD student ever. Okay, well, before we dive into that, why don't you just give a like, brief what brought you to TKS and what's the core memory you have from the program experience?
Yeah, for sure. I first heard about TKS through some friends of friends who were in one of the initial cohorts back in like the early Toronto days. I think coming into TKS, I knew I wanted to do science, but I knew for a fact that learning from like this amazing like, cross-disciplinary community of like builders, young engineers, hustlers, I knew at that moment that like learning from people who didn't exactly only think like me and who would challenge me to think in other ways and work harder on these things that are actually very important, like soft skills, learning how to, you know, go deep in things, learning how to have a why. I had a feeling that, you know, being in that environment would be like a launch pad for me personally. And joining TKS, in the end, it turned out to be that launch pad that I was hoping for. So incredibly grateful for that experience to this day. I think core memory, as someone who, I guess, like had a lot of conviction on doing science and being like a biologist or a researcher, I think a really cool memory for me was like sitting in like a law office, like the office of Faskin LLP.
Yeah.
And doing
a throwback.
Yeah, and doing like this pro bono consulting gig with them, you know, thanks to TKS, and just kind of sitting there in astonishment, like this should never have happened, you know what I mean? Like this, and there would be no other parallel universe with this where I would be sitting here getting this kind of crazy pro bono consulting experience had it not been for TKS, and I'm forever grateful for that. I didn't know at the time, but though the skills that I learned in experiences like that, like some of our earlier challenges, like the Kidogo challenge, they ended up being extremely monumental for me in growing both as a engineer, as a scientist, as a presenter, as a communicator, etc. So yeah.
You're glowing. That it's so cool because when we're in that world where everyone's consulting pro bono for Fastkin and Kidoga, like this is also normalized. But I think it's so interesting now that we're out of the program because we realize what a blip in space-time that we were existing in. Like, what a random set of circumstances. And you realize that that really isn't normal. And I feel like it bonds us in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really hard to, like that's like such a specific experience, like doing pro bono consulting at age, like, 16, 17, 18.
100%.
And, like, you know, whether it's Fastkin or Wealthsimple or Walmart, I mean, all of these amazing challenges that we had, I mean, yeah, they're so memorable. We learned a lot.
We learned a lot, but it's also, today I was literally having a conversation with someone. They're like, so, like, how did you have Microsoft on your resume? And I'm like, there is no short answer for me to explain, you know, the circumstances that brought me to that Microsoft all hands conference. It's a really, really long story.
Yeah, TKS is kind of like a super enabler of that crazy serendipity, mm-hmm. right? And I think like that is like a force multiplier in your life, or can be for sure. And it's been amazing. Just to flip it on you, what's been your favorite memory? I'm just curious now.
Ooh. Okay. So something I've appreciated recently is kind of what we were on the lines of talking about is just being able to reconnect with people where I can say Kidogo and you don't need context.
Yeah.
And that's really special. Or to have a place like Nando's or Toronto where I can walk the street and it's like distinctly nerdy but awesome memories. I think and like now that I look back, it's like a place where I feel belonging. That's been difficult to attain in different environments. So as a macro trend, that is awesome. As a micro trend, I think it has to be the WeWork, like the WeWork environment, just running into people and genuinely being so excited to be around like ambitious young people. I mean, it's such a cliche. We use those words all the time that they almost lose their meaning, but I don't know. I think it's really special.
That's amazing. Yeah. I feel like we almost take this for granted still.
We do.
I think a lot of, we still think it's still like kind of normalized to be around these crazy people like years after graduating from TKS, and it's a beautiful sight to see, you know, seeing where everyone goes and catching up, like, you know, 3 years, 5 years, God forbid, 10 years later, what things are going to look like, you know?
Totally. Cool. So I want to hear your multi-year plan, PhD and everything. I want to hear the whole process.
Yeah, for sure. I thought I had a multi-year plan. 2 years, like right out of TKS, you know, I was going to do undergrad and then do a PhD and then create a biotech company and help a few 100,000 people maybe, or help a bunch of people make millions of dollars and, you know, and then chill or build another company, repeat the process. It's just a very ambitious kind of like grandiose plan. And I think how I look at it now is like, I still eventually want to be a part of a startup or build my own startup involving building therapeutics, likely for cancer. But I'm actually more so now focused on the journey of getting there rather than heading off the checkboxes. Like before, building a company was the goal. For me right now, how I'm looking at it is, I just want to build a therapy that approaches cancer in a way that we aren't currently looking at right now. I'm taking like a unique shot on cancer. Because there's plenty of extremely driven and smart people in the race to build the best monoclonal antibody, to build the best CAR T cell, to build the best CAR NK cell. These are all like experimental new cancer therapies.
Yeah.
There's tons of smart PhDs, MD PhDs, and amazing kick-ass executives who are building startups in this space. Me as a scientist, my unique advantage, my unfair advantage is trying to ask a pointed question that might reveal a weak spot that we haven't looked at before. And so that's kind of the way I want to look at it now, my career development as a scientist and eventually as a bioengineer / therapeutic developer. You know, that focus on the outcome versus focus on the journey and the skills I develop and the person I become in pursuing these like large, you know, these like large scale directions is kind of the main focus change I have. I would probably give myself a couple of years also just to like figure out what I want to do after a PhD. Because I'm very sure I want to do a PhD. This is something I've thought about for multiple years and I'm very determined to do it.
Amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
the
you.
World needs your PhD thesis, I'm convinced.
But but then after that, I mean, that's like what, like 5 years from now? Me 5 years ago, I had no idea I thought about life very differently. And so I think giving myself that flexibility to kind of like allow myself to experience the next few years and know, and then from there, like basically make my make a smaller roadmap towards the direction that I want to go in, like, you know, building a therapy to, in that is like more like uniquely designed compared to what's currently out there. Having in a few years, basically being able to build that smaller roadmap will, I think that's probably the strategy that I want to go with in terms of leading my life, having that like operational flexibility.
Amazing. So tell us about this new cell therapy that you're working on. Or the new cell, specifically.
Oh, yeah. So astrocytes. Yeah. So yeah. So I guess I'll give it some context of what I was working at MIT, and then I can kind of tie it into what I'm doing now. Coming into MIT, I had the chance to work with two labs. I was co-supervised by Anne Grabiel, who was like a senior neuroscientist at the McGovern Institute of Brain Cognitive Sciences. She studies the deep part of the brain called the striatum. And she studies these specific like cellular compartments in the striatum called striatomes, which she discovered back in the 90s. And she got like a presidential award from George Bush over it.
Wow.
So yeah, she's amazing. She's one of the first female professors at MIT as well. She's still kicking it, doing her thing.
How old is she?
81, I believe.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, she's traveling around the world. She's doing her thing. She has more energy than I will ever have at age 61, let alone 81. So yeah, she's amazing. And so I worked with her. I got to work with two McGovern fellows, principal investigators who aren't professors yet. So basically two fresh PhDs, people who just graduated their PhDs who now got a lab. So yeah, postdocs who run their own lab in a way. That's pretty awesome.
Postdoc PI. Yeah.
They are a PI. And so I got to work with Omar Abdiya and Jonathan Gutenberg, these two McGovern fellows, and I got to work with Anne Grabiel. So it's co-supervised by two labs, and the place I spent most of my time was the Abagut lab or Abdiya Gutenberg lab. So in the Abagut lab, I was working on a couple of like platform technologies. The first one was this thing called radars. Radars is basically like an RNA sensor. It's a piece of RNA that can detect messenger RNA. So it's like reverse complementary to a messenger RNA. And basically this radar's RNA, if you design it to be complementary to a messenger RNA of your choice, then it'll translate a protein. So it's like a two-part system in a way, a sensor and a payload. There's a messenger RNA sensor, so it's reverse complementary to any messenger RNA you want it to be complementary to. And then there's a payload, a fully encoded protein ready to go. And basically what radars allows you to do is almost create like a biological if-true statement. If we're in this type of cell that has this messenger RNA, then translate any protein I want, or theoretically any protein I want. Wow. We can make a neuron turn green. We can make a cancer cell explode and do everything in between that. And so radars is a pretty amazing technology. It's what brought me to the Abagut lab. And so I was working on that technology platform, helping optimize it, build it out, especially for therapeutic use cases. And with the Grabiel lab, I was helping deploy it for some of their work in the brain. And also on the flip side, second technology platform I was working on was this thing called Fansource. Now Fansource is a eukaryotic CRISPR in a way. It's like a eukaryotic CRISPR cousin. So CRISPR is this gene editing technology that's kind of changed the world of biotech for the last like decade now. And we know CRISPR now as the bacterial immune system that we've managed to co-opt into being a genetic engineering tool. And the story, you know, that's kind of the evolutionary story. CRISPR was an immune system that bacteria have. Basically, when a virus invades the bacterial cell, the CRISPR system is kind of like a library, a memory that stores the virus's DNA in a little array. And whenever that virus comes back, the bacteria can pick up that virus DNA and cut it up before it integrates and destroys the cell. And so that's kind of the story that we understood CRISPR by. Fansource, which just came out, which is like basically coming out as we speak, and over the last like month or two, it's a very, very hot topic now. Fansource is basically like a virus attack system that viruses use to invade the cell. And so basically what viruses use to invade eukaryotic cells. And so integrated into the genome of eukaryotes is this nucleus, this thing that can be RNA guided and then cut DNA. Kind of like how CRISPR-Cas9 works, but now in eukaryotes. So it's kind of changing the evolutionary story. And we were basically harnessing these like proteins, these natural proteins, as like gene editors and trying to make them work as gene editors. So two technology platforms being used, as well as an application project that I was doing in the Grabiel lab for the brain research using radars.
And how do you spell it, just so if people want to Google Fansource?
Yeah, Fanzors, Fansource.
Cool.
Yeah, and so
people with me, I want to Google it,
but I yeah, 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 yeah. It's so cool. Yeah, and the other one's called radars.
Yeah. 2023.
Yeah, it's super new, super new.
June 28th, 2023. Whoa.
Yeah. And so Yeah, Fansers is a crazy new topic, and there's only, I think there's been a few labs that have published about it now. There's our lab, yeah. There's Song Jung Lab, who's like across the street from our lab in Boston, or in Cambridge, I should say.
Whoa.
And then there's Jennifer Doudna, the Nobel Prize winning scientist who discovered, who characterized Cas9 as a gene editing tool.
Have you read the Walter Isaacson book?
I actually haven't. I mean, The Codebreaker, right?
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. Jennifer Doudna.
Yeah. I've done some research to Jennifer Doudna's the story, but I actually haven't read the full book yet, and I've been meaning to.
Yeah.
It's still a copy for my friends. Yeah, so now going to UFT, can I answer your question? The aim is to basically bring the radar technology to University of Toronto to basically study astrocytes, these like fairly unknown population of glial cells in the brain that are seemingly very important for brain function and for recovery in different like neurological diseases, but we don't exactly know what they're doing, and we know the outcomes of what they do, but we don't actually know how they work. And so I'm stepping in with this bioengineering tool and hoping to better profile that.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
So you're in a science program, but effectively you're doing a lot of engineering. How do you feel like you chose the right university program, or tell me about that science versus engineering split in your academic
career? Yeah, this is actually pretty interesting because it's informing a lot of the way I actually apply to grad school as well. Because I'm not a formally trained engineer. I'm not in an engineering program. I don't have an iron ring. But almost all of the research I've done has been bioengineering focused, whether it's like device building before I went to MIT, or, you know, molecular engineering platform development at MIT, or, you know, now like deploying these molecular engineering tools to study the brain at U of T. You know, a lot of my practical experience has been in this design iteration cycle. That's kind of how I've seen research for the last like few years, and I've been trained to see research for the last few years. So how I'll break it down is this. One of the biggest principles in engineering is to fully understand the problem that you're working with. And a lot of times engineers fail to do this. And what ends up happening is that you use a toolkit that you're very good at, or the, you know, toolkit that you're used to working with, and you will retrofit it onto the problem that you have without fully understanding a lot of the nuances of the problem. This is a problem that you can see in like almost like civil engineering cases, or in just like engineering, like a whole like incentive systems, like systems design engineering. Especially if you don't understand like certain like geographical context or dynamics of the people you're going to be working with. Or in the case of biology, when we're doing bioengineering, if you're building a therapy and we don't fully understand the nuances and the fun little quirks of the biological system that you're working with, or the disease that you're working with, you will very likely end up engineering something that isn't that optimal, or that might fail altogether. And so I think as a scientist, it's kind of training that at least I went for in like immunology and genetics, it really helped like inform me with this like foundational knowledge that allows me kind of like better probe and study like a biological system before I try to bioengineer a solution to solve a question that we have in mind. It basically allows me to be a more effective bioengineer. And even though I don't know as many bioengineering techniques as like a fully trained bioengineer, you know, would, who did this stuff during their degree, that foundational bio knowledge is basically allowing me to better understand the problem, which I think allows me to do a pretty good job. Despite not getting that.
And you know what? I think what makes that a really profound statement is you're able to really understand the context and the second order effects. If you change this thing, you can maybe more deeply consider the implications, rather than being someone who just has tools in the toolkit. You just look at the toolkit, you like look at your assumptions of a problem, you kind of like pick and choose from there. You can almost work backwards. And I think it's a really meaningful perspective. And what you said earlier, which I really resonate with, which is your unfair advantage. How can you take that like unique science bio perspective and apply that in a way that becomes your unique and unfair advantage?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of bioengineers, they have their own unfair advantage when they work with scientists, because they can start thinking about biology in like a logical design iteration framework. And basically, because of the skills that they learn, they can apply a bunch of different techniques to basically probe a scientific question. And so ultimately, you know, being a cross-discipline team is good. You know, work with engineers, work with scientists, marry both skill sets.
Be a bit of both.
Yeah. Work with people who can compliment you, and do the thing.
So what questions are you asking for your PhD? I don't know, how does it work when you apply? Like when you apply for these, are you looking at specific advisors, your questions? Tell me about the process.
Yeah. So just on the note of like the difference between American and Canadian systems, when you apply to grad school, it is also different.
Okay. So and you're applying in Canada? Or in the
I'm applying to both. I'm applying to both countries. So
the UK?
No UK, unfortunately.
Why?
Just Canada and the US. Okay. It's mainly a couple things. I think time zone difference is one, and I think also just the stipends. The graduate stipends, at least for bio programs in the UK, aren't that competitive. They're quite low, relatively speaking, and I can't really afford to do that. But
you should apply for like the Rhodes.
The Rhodes, yeah, the Rhodes scholarship is definitely an option. That requires school sponsorship, and so
does it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, your school needs to like nominate you to go to the Rhodes scholarship. Okay. Also, I think the deadline already passed, but
fair enough.
Yeah. So Canada, the Canadian and United States PhD environments are a bit different. So both on average for PhD programs are about 5 years in both systems, are about 5-6 years, usually around 5 years. But in a lot of American, almost every American program, when you apply, you are applying to a grad department and not so much to an advisor specifically. So you're applying to that department, that department will decide whether or not to let you in. And then you'll rotate with different advisors for your first year or your first year and a half. And then you'll pick your advisor at the end of that rotation period. And, you know, you'll see who's a good match. Versus in Canada, for the most part, with some exceptions that have rotation programs, in Canada, you are applying to a program and you have an advisor already picked out. So it's a lot more of a personal application in some ways where, you know, you've already talked to the advisor, you've already, you know, kind of got this deal worked out. And you'll be coming in to study this specific question with this specific person for like, you know, your 5 or 5.5 or 6 or 7 years during your PhD. And so it's a bit of a different dynamic, I'd say, you know, but both systems generally have a pretty holistic approach where they look at your grades from your last 2 years. They look at your research experience, look at your reference letters, your personal statement, et cetera. And so there's a lot of similarities, but also a lot of differences between the grad programs. Yeah.
That's awesome. And when you apply to Canada right now, what question are you applying with?
Yeah, so the question that I have in mind is what is the role of the inflammatory environment or like the inflammation surrounding a tumor cell before it becomes a full-fledged tumor? And how does that change the behavior of the cancer itself? When you look at how cancer research is done right now, what we see is we basically see this fixation on transcript markers, like certain proteins of the genes that the cancer cell is expressing, whether they be surface markers or they be like internal, like cytosolic markers. Either way, we have a big fixation on like what genes is the cell expressing. And for good reason, this has basically informed our therapeutic strategy for like a decade now, or way more than a decade now, I should say. Like we literally define cancers sometimes by some of the proteins that they express, like HER2 positive breast cancer, for example. And so that paradigm of cancer research has gotten us pretty far, but I think that the next generation of cancer therapies, if we're looking like beyond CAR-T, beyond CAR-NK, beyond monoclonal antibodies, I think the next generation of cancer is going to come from basically tuning inflammation and looking at whole systems approach to cancer versus like looking at specific markers of cancer cells and then trying to kill them. The inherent problem of like looking at specific markers in a big cancer, in like a cancer tumor and targeting those markers is basically you're doing a selection experiment. For those of us who are not in biology, a selection experiment is basically when you have like a bunch of like different cells or different organisms in like a biological system or like an environment, you basically kill everything based on like a couple, like one or two or X amount of features. The problem is that how life works is that when you do that, usually there's something that survives. A lot of times something will survive after your intervention. If you apply enough bacteria, if you apply enough antibiotics to a bacteria, so like a bacterial infection over like a whole population, eventually you're going to get a bacteria that's resistant to that drug. Same thing goes with cancer. Sometimes we think of tumors as like a big mass of like, you know, these like messed up cells, these deranged cancer cells. But in reality, tumors are extremely like complicated and they're extremely almost impressively designed in a way where you have this like extreme diversity in different cell types. You have fibroblasts there, you have immune cells there. It's like a little city competing against your body. You get almost like gruesomely fascinated by what's happening because it's this entire city that's like fighting against you. The tumor microenvironment is actively trying to, you know, let itself survive and grow. And so when we use single microbiology to target tumors, the problem is that we just basically do a selection experiment. We'll kill X amount of cells and sometimes some survive. And that tends to lead to what we call relapse. So even if you do a good cancer therapy, there's literally like a percentage factor chance that, you know, this is going to relapse. And usually it's because some cancer cells, yeah, they just didn't have the marker you were looking for. Or even fun fact, they may have had the marker you were looking for, but they had another marker. And so, like, the fact that your thing didn't wasn't like an and, it wasn't like A and B kill, yeah. It was more like signal A kill, yeah. That allowed the cell with A and B to survive somehow. This is like what we call like clonality, cancer clonality. Yeah. It gets very complicated the deeper you go, but basically, we're targeting one target in a big diversity of tumor cells. It can kill everything, but a lot of times it also doesn't kill everything. And you can throw a bunch of therapies to kind of keep digging down and keep killing cells based on these markers and more markers. But I think to really revolutionize how we're going to do cancer therapy in the future, we need to look at it through a bigger lens. And I think chronic inflammation, understanding how inflammation works to develop a cancer and to keep it alive, I think understanding this, a very crucial puzzle piece to being able to develop that next generation of cancer therapies that we may not even be able to like fathom right now.
Yeah. Okay, so this might be a stretch, but I was reading about, I don't know if the glioblastoma polio, where they use polio to target glioblastoma in the brain, and then they, I don't know, does this ring a bell for you? No?
I haven't seen this, but like, it sounds like a phage therapy.
It's an oncovirus therapy, yeah. And it was really interesting because they did this clinical trial at Duke University, which is down the road from UNC. And what was interesting about it is, throughout the trial, they kind of varied the amount of the polio vaccine, the polio virus that they were injecting. Yeah. And a lot of the patients ended up dying because of the inflammatory response in the brain. So even though the therapy was effective, it was just like that inflammation response. And it rang a bell based on what you were saying, because obviously you're kind of flipping the way we define cancer on its head by almost shifting the focus from markers to inflammation. And I think it's so important because when you think about the definition of what is a cancer cell? Well, a cancer cell is a regular cell that's kind of gone to this like anarchist dictator state of trying to, you know, build a new empire, which is a tumor, whether that's solid state or blood-based cancers. And it's so interesting because fundamentally that's like our immune system is broken because it's a regular cell turned a little bit, you know, evil in a way. And to ignore our immune system's response is like such a naive thing for us to do. Anyway, that's like what that came to. But I know they're like glioblastoma is one of the least curable cancers of the brain. So it's like a super important, you know, set of research.
Yeah. So was astrocytomas actually on an interesting note there for brain cancers. Yeah. 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 So even when we talked about the inflammation caused by that, like the lysis probably of these viruses.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that was it.
Yeah. So when we trigger inflammation or when we deal with acute inflammation, like in the case of the viruses, like blowing up a cell, and like lysing the cell and all the cell debris, you know, leaking out and causing like a rapid inflammatory response. Versus when we talk about like the inflammatory response you get around a cancer cell that allows it to grow, it basically shows you how diverse even the definition of inflammation can get. There's a ton of research nowadays coming out about how chronic inflammation is like responsible for all kinds of different age-related diseases, even genetic diseases like, or even genetic conditions like autism actually, and the inflammatory connection between like a pregnant mother getting sick during like the first trimester of pregnancy and the odds of a child developing. It's like the whole field of research called maternal immune activation or MIA. That's like a link here.
I've never and heard so basically, of that. That's really cool.
Yeah. And so like chronic inflammation or acute inflammation has so much impact, and inflammation isn't really a single state so much as like a whole spectrum of states, each with their own mechanism, their own pathway. And so understanding what types of inflammation are at play when a cancer is developing, what types of inflammation are at play when a cancer is trying to survive and grow and metastasize, I think understanding these are kind of one of the major stepping stones that we need to uncover before we can really unlock like the next generation of cancer therapies. And that's what I'm hoping to study my PhD around.
Oh my gosh, so it's incredible because the degree I'm studying chemistry/chemical innovation/biochemistry, whatever you want to call it, it's so interesting because I feel like it gives me mechanisms, which is exactly the word that you just used. And there's a variety of classes that I take. But what I love about it is it feels like I'm building a set of analogies that I can use to understand different systems of the world. So when we think about, for example, a tumor environment and something that we want to eradicate, we might also kind of like draw some parallels to wildfire prevention or how like, you know, you burn stuff in the forest and like, you know what I mean? Like there's so many analogies. And I find that just studying the complexity of a couple of systems creates models that you can use to study the complexity of many other systems. And that's what makes this kind of stuff exciting.
It almost becomes like an intuition after a certain point.
Yeah.
Once you establish that, like that base foundation, you can use that intuition to go into a new system and try to understand it. Obviously, there's a lot of nuances that that system has that you're, you know, the systems that you study before don't have, but that intuition does help you significantly, you know, that foundational basis. And I think that definitely allows you to be a better engineer once it comes time to like actually think about what solutions can be built. Yeah,
for sure. And I actually want to really appreciate what you said earlier about how we define cancer by these sort of markers and how that kind of clouds the way we are thinking about the disease. This is going to be a stretch, but I'm taking a class right now, which is about marginality in ancient Greece and antiquity. So looking at women and immigrants. And I was reading this paper, which is about what they called proto-racism in antiquity. And basically there's a line, and I have my notes pulled up, where they talk about how it's really difficult to study this concept because prejudice or racism, these are not words that even existed in the literature. But then they go on and they highlight that the reason that these words or these concepts may not have existed is because there existed no intellectual, moral, or emotional objections against these generalizations. So against the generalizations of, for example, groups of immigrants being barbaric, or against the generalizations of people of different skin backgrounds. And it was just so normalized that no one even questioned. And that goes back to exactly what you were saying, is that what assumptions have we kind of forgot about and appreciated? Can we actually just flip the way we define cancer and discover something new? I don't know. I don't know if you see that connection, but that's what it just reminded me of.
No, I do. And I'm like, going back to that analogy on like the Greek history note, I mean,
yeah.
Like, the humanist ideals of equality and like the idea that people shouldn't be discriminated against, even that is like kind of a stretch for you know, that's kind of a modern innovation in terms of philosophy. And even that was built on the grounds of racism, right? Like that was supposed to be grounds of like unifying colonial powers and colonizers, not necessarily unifying the colonized with the colonizers. So I think it'd be hard to call it racism because our idea of race came from that, like, that kind of like pre-colonial era. But yeah. going on the note of cancer, this is kind of goes back to the question of we don't know what we don't know. Tying it back to the, like your question about like mental model, like mindset, I'm trying to apply like, you know, what are the questions that we aren't asking? Yeah, I feel like this is one of the underappreciated questions that we're at. There's a ton of underappreciated questions, both in terms of the longevity and the aging space and also in the cancer space. And I feel like this is the unanswered question that is kind of keeping me up at night. I don't know if I ever really felt this much conviction over a question before. And I think that's kind of why I'm like pretty dead set on doing a PhD to kind of try to answer this question. Yeah.
Amazing. And you know how I know you're a good scientist? This interview, you are weaving everything together. It's like no knot is going untied. Your mindset goes into your PhD and it goes into this thing. It really shows, because I think that's what differs a scientist from, say, an engineer, in that an engineer is kind of like applying one directionally. And I mean, engineers are amazing, but what's making you a scientist is you're looping back and you're actually questioning those assumptions and you're trying to create knowledge. It's not just create change, it's creating knowledge. And to create knowledge, you have to be accurate. And to be accurate, you have to go back in loops.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I think so, yeah. And then eventually you want to eventually I want to actively change and go back to the engineering work. But
absolutely.
At least for now, I want to kind of like dig at it and find some unique insight and then hopefully build something cool from there.
Totally. And to draw back to cancer, it's like when you think about the regulation of these kind of abnormal cells, it's our immune system doing checks. But as soon as those checks stop, you now have the progression of the disease. That's why I've even informed like political or like organizational, I should say, opinions off of that, like off of the biology of our bodies and when our bodies are most optimal. I don't know if you feel the same way, but sometimes I just think, I'm like, what is cancer? And what's the behavior of that? And are there ways that we're taking that like kind of behavior in terms of like unregulated checking or like the tumor microbe? Like sometimes that's how my brain thinks. I'm just like, whoa, I learned about, you know, how these genes turn into oncogenes. Are there parallels to that mechanism that like manifests at a macro organizational scale, political scale, a business scale? What are things that we can learn from our bodies?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think, I mean, you could find the principles of nature.
Yeah.
Everywhere, right? And even it's kind of humbling when you look at how our school of thought has been of like conquering nature. Mm-hmm. That kind of like conquer nature school of thought that dominated the 20th century, a lot of 20th century like post-industrial era thinking when it came to like building infrastructure. In both superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, they both have this like conquer nature approach. But then if you look at a satellite image of our cities, they very much resemble cells. when you look at the patterns of the electricity, where it's like you have a nucleus and you have like dendrites.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like spreading out. It looks like a giant petri dish in a funny little. it's really funny when you see that.
So actually, talking about cities and North America and bio, you were talking about time zones, and it just made me think, like, so you are saying that North America is kind of like the center of action for biotech. Would you agree with that? And if not, where are some of those epicenters, and why is time zone even important in this kind of work?
So, yeah, so I'll preface myself. When I said time zone initially, I was talking about more like coordinating myself and my family.
Okay, cool.
but scheduling meetings with Europe is hard. You're on PST. I'll say that. Like, it's very hard. I'm going to schedule meetings with Europe. So in terms of like biotech hubs, I mean, I think what we're seeing now is that biotech is getting a lot more decentralized. And this is largely thanks to a lot of community efforts in the biotech community that are trying to decentralize like biotech. It's actually really inspiring to see. I mean, you have organizations like Nucleate that are basically democratizing the process of like spinning up startups from graduate school for PhDs around the world. And so these communities have a global scale and have a global outreach, which is incredible to see. And, you know, that allows kind of like a lot more cross-border collaboration. With that said, there are, of course, the giants that we cannot ignore in terms of like, you know, the biotech hub. What SF is for tech, undoubtedly, you know, Boston kind of comes to mind. Bay Area is extremely strong as well. I'd say London, the London, Oxford, Cambridge corridor, Oxbridge, incredibly strong.
ETH, what about Canada?
In Canada, Toronto. Toronto is definitely like an incredible place. Yeah. Vancouver is kind of slept on, actually. Vancouver is like the birthplace of Canadian biotech, actually. And then, of course, you know, Toronto has incredible infrastructure for life science research and biotech development. Montreal is also very solid. One city that I will give a shout out to, and I think they're really building out, is Calgary. So Calgary is actually really emerging. Calgary is like one of the fastest growing economic centers in Canada. And basically, some of the grad programs there offer very competitive stipends, actually even more competitive than Toronto schools, than some of the Toronto programs here. Calgary is growing, and we should definitely give a special shout out to Calgary and keep it on the radar, because I think Calgary will develop into like an amazing biotech and tech hub, for that matter, as it grows. Yeah, in America, Boston and SF, the Bay Area, are definitely huge. The research triangle in
I was going to ask, where's the research triangle?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely cannot sleep in the research triangle. Huge, huge place. For biotech research. San Diego as well, amazing. And I think one that people don't talk about that's just an absolute behemoth is the Texas biotech / biopharma ecosystem.
Yes.
Incredibly huge. Like, yeah, some of the most cutting edge clinical trials are all done at like Southwest Medical Center, for example, in cancer. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like Houston, Dallas, incredible hubs for medicine and
Mayo Clinic. I mean, Mayo Clinic's all over, but they started, I'm pretty sure, in Minnesota.
Mayo Clinic is definitely a huge one. They're distributed. It kind of allows them to be more geographically agnostic. But yeah, I think I'm pretty sure they started out in Minnesota. Yeah.
Yeah. No, the world is cool. Well, so where have you heard of anything happening in Asia? I mean, other than Singapore, I know we kind of briefly chat. I love Singapore. It's my whole heart.
Yeah. I didn't actually get a chance to shout out a lot of places who are doing crazy stuff in biotech.
Cool.
I think mainland China is becoming the dominant bioengineering research source. I mean, the Chinese National Academy of Science, the CNAS, I mean, they were ranked by Nature as like the biggest contributors to science for the last couple of years now, I think. And so basically China's version of the NSF / like plus, is an absolute behemoth across like multiple disciplines, including like, you know, clinical research, bioengineering, especially in the bioengineering department, like molecular engineering platforms. They are very much like competing with the leading institutions in the United States. Yeah, China's research scene is going off. And it's kind of incredible to see. And yeah, I think also Korea and Japan have some amazing universities that are doing very solid work. Kyoto University in Japan, you have SNU and KAIST in Korea, doing incredible life sciences research as well. But I think, yeah, National University of Singapore is definitely like one of the top leaders outside of like Northeast Asia in Asia for like bio research.
No, amazing. Yeah. So where do you want to travel next? What would be a dream bio nerdy vacation?
I think this is more so along the lines of personally where I want to go, as well as like where it would be cool to do research. I'd be really excited to kind of work in Germany or the Netherlands or even Sweden, actually. Amsterdam or working for the Karolinska Institute in Sweden or working in Turnigen in Germany, like at Max Planck or something. Yeah, I think spending some time in Western Europe or like even the Nordic countries would be pretty amazing and pretty awesome.
I don't know what you do during Nobel Prize Week, but I've gotten a lot of enjoyment of just like, I wake up, they announce the prize at like 7 a.m. Eastern time. So I like get up, I do like a little tea and the Nobel Prize. So much fun, I highly recommend. But I would this year, I think it's first week of October, I'm pretty sure. And then in December, they always have like the Nobel Mind and it just comes out and I'm like, it's so much fun.
You're very well traveled. Like, where would you want to go?
Ooh, next? Yeah, I'm pretty well traveled. I spent the last year traveling. Like, that was kind of a gap year. But, like, I did a semester at the National University of Singapore, which was fantastic. And then I did some work. I worked for a company in Singapore, did product management work. And then I traveled a bunch, Thailand, Cambodia. Cambodia was my favorite country, actually. Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Taiwan, so many different places. And then this summer, I worked for a Canadian foundation that had a project going in Burundi, which is a small East African country. And it was incredible just to be on ground with the clinic and really supporting kind of like a more strategic vision and like making it happen, which is really cool, and quality improvement. I think that I really want to go to Turkey. That's kind of one of the big next countries. I also really want to go to Morocco. Just food and vibes are there. Germany, like there's so many places that I would want to end up in.
You go to Germany, you meet a lot of Turkish communities there too.
Yeah. Oh, I heard the doner kebabs in Germany are fantastic.
the community in Germany is huge. I mean, it'd be amazing to meet some of the people there and hear their stories. I mean, it's been like there since I'm pretty sure the 80s or maybe I'm pretty sure the 80s. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of Middle Eastern kind of refuge happening in Germany, and that's kind of like you said, I think from the 80s or maybe even before then. And that's what I love about different places is Germany is not just what we think of as like German people. It actually has a lot of pockets, just like Toronto. Like, what's a Torontonian? Like, there's way too many types. And there's so many little subgroups, and that's what makes learning about places special, is like appreciating their nuance.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the EU has kind of been a huge enabler of that, raising diversity in a lot of like traditionally more like homogenous places or ethnically homogenous places. So it's pretty awesome to see.
Yeah.
I want to see for myself too when I go there.
Yeah. Are you going to, so you're going straight into, you're not doing like a gap summer, a gap year or anything like that, right?
I'll take my summer off and I'll probably do a much needed return trip to Taiwan and Vietnam. Yeah. I have like some close family friends in Taiwan that I want to visit. Taiwan's also my favorite place in the whole world.
Wow. So I love Taipei. It was amazing.
Taipei is cool, but I feel like to really experience Taipei in Taiwan, the mountains and also the coastline.
I didn't do the coastline, but I did go to the mountains.
It was awesome. Ooh, okay, yeah. The mountains are fun. They got some pretty cool geothermal parks there. Ooh. But the coast of Taiwan is where you got to be. I mean, Taiwan is an island. Fully appreciating the coast, the seafood, it's unbeatable. There's these fun little places, especially in the smaller cities and even some of the rural towns in Taiwan, where it's like, I don't know the name for it, but it's like basically a place where usually dads and uncles will take their nephews and or like kids to like basically go to this is basically a big pool full of shrimp and prawns, and you buy a bucket of bait and you just like fish in this pool, and then you basically, the rule is like you cook what you catch. You buy your bait, you can just like fish there for like however long you want, like usually on like a Sunday evening, teach your kids how to fish. Yeah, it's just such a vibe. It's a beautiful place overall. And for anyone who's like listening, who's a very big anime fan, especially if they watch like Studio Ghibli movies, there are actually some iconic Studio Ghibli scenes that are directly taken from places in Taiwan. Yeah.
Yeah. Where in Vietnam do you go, or will you go?
Yeah, in Vietnam. So in Vietnam, I mean, my family's from Vietnam, so I'll be visiting. My family is in the far south of Vietnam. There's a place called Sóc Trăng. Okay. It's fairly close to the Cambodian border. I'll drive. Yeah, hopefully, gonna land, see the south of Vietnam a little more, visit my family, and then maybe try to drive across the border to Cambodia. We'll see how that goes.
Why not?
It's a super common road. It's a pretty common road trip as well that a lot of people, at least in my area, make. And so I think it'd be pretty awesome.
But I really hope you get to go to Angkor Wat. Angkor Wat is like one of my favorite places. It was.
I really do want to go to. And
there's a reason.
Yeah, I'm hoping to see Istanbul. I also see like the eastern part of Turkey. It's very culturally different from like the part closer to like Greece and the western side of Turkey, basically. The western side of Anatolia. It'd be really cool to see the eastern part. It's that culture difference.
Totally. I don't know if Turkey's going to happen anytime soon, because I feel like that's like a rigorous trip that I really want to do well. But yeah. I mean, we'll see. Like, I'm just kind of open to life. But I'm definitely like in love with Southeast Asia, and I would love to move there ASAP. So that's the plan.
You should really connect with Sadlan if you haven't done it yet, because he did a big Southeast Asia and Turkey trip actually.
Oh, perfect. This is the person. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, amazing. So I do have rapid fire questions, but I'm wondering, is there anything else that you want to touch on in the last like couple of years that you have really learned before we get to the rapid fire?
Yeah, I think so. If the majority of the audience here are people who are like, I'm going to assume like high schoolers or in a TKS program, one thing I will say is that
our friends too, Michael. Our friends.
Yeah, and our friends. Yeah. But basically, you know, as students, both in high school and university, the one thing that won't change is the fact that you're a student and that you're exposed to all these people and that your friend group is, your social circle is relatively large. And as you slowly get older, your social circle tends to get smaller and smaller. And then once you graduate, that really comes to reality, like social circle getting smaller. So because I did this extra year of internship, co-op year, I'm back at University of Toronto for, like, you know, my final year, but it's actually my fifth year. It's been 5 years since I started university. But, you know, that means most of my friends who I started first year with, they've already graduated now. And they're going into their full September outside of school, going into the working world. And they're telling me about how their social circles have just gotten super small and condensed compared to what it was even like a year ago, let alone like first year of college or second year of college. And so, like, I think, you know, for those of us who are like, you know, curious about college or going into college or, you know, maybe starting college, really try to find that group of friends that you really jive with and that you could see yourself like spending like a good amount of your social time, your free social time with, because those are going to be the people that make up your likely limited social group outside of work and professional career.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, find those people, try to find your tribe, because it's probably one of the most important things you can do for yourself while we're all this age. Yeah.
Yeah. And if I could like pop in, I think something I've learned is you have to be courageous, both in what you want out of your friends, but also in like meeting them where they're at. For example, it was my birthday recently, and I was like, I want to do a Paul Graham essay night. And yeah, thank you. And I knew it was something that a lot of people just like wouldn't care about. And it was interesting because like on one side of my brain, it's like, oh, I want to have lots of people because like that's like fun and whatever. And on the other side, I was like, you know what? Like the six good people who want to eat my like very good, I did an excellent job of making Middle Eastern tacos, and who want to like print a Paul Graham essay and like come and read it with me. Like these are the people that are worth it. And so when I say be courageous, something that I'm trying to learn to be really comfortable with is just to be the person I want to be, and who that attracts, it attracts. And if it's small, it's small. Yeah. And that's just the way it is, like quality over quantity. And I'm really appreciating that. And so that's kind of like what that reminds me of. Yeah.
That's such an awesome concept, by the way, for your birthday. Like huge shout out for doing that. Yeah, like have your values set, be your unapologetic self, and be kind, and then try your best to find your social circle. I think that's like the best advice any college student needs to hear, honestly. Yeah,
and I think it can be lonely, and I think that's something that I've experienced, is that I assumed that these like education-based learning, you know, environments, like this is no, like university, what, even though we kind of think of it as like a thing that everyone has started to do in educated places, like it is a choice, right? When you go from kindergarten to grade 12, like that is to some extent not a choice. That is a government protocol. So I kind of assumed that going into learning-based institutions that you opt in and take a lot of debt for, that people would kind of like self-filter for that love of learning. But I've realized there's like a lot of people, and that's kind of what you brought up. It's like you meet so many people who are in places for so many different reasons. They have different goals, and not everyone is inquisitive in the same ways that I'm inquisitive. Yeah, it's something that I've learned to know myself, have standards for myself, and be courageous for who I want to be. And if that means like I'm going to have experiences of loneliness, like the authenticity is worth it in the end, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Once we're put through a system for like 12 years of like, you know, a little more than 12 years actually, put through a system of 12 years of like having a set of goals and objectives and going through these hoops and always climbing for the next rung, it's not a surprise that a lot of us end up continuing the path. Can you continuing that path? Like I found it for myself for the longest time. I was guilty of this too. Basically taking the next logical step, given my skills and my expertise. And I think a big question I've been thinking about recently is like, what are the things about my current trajectory that I actually want to do? And what are the things that I feel like I should be doing because I'm, you know, I have potential there. I guess a final thought before we get to rapid fire questions I'll leave with is like, you know, recognizing your potential is super important, and then recognizing what aspects of that potential that you want to work on, that you want to like really hit, you know, hit the gas pedal on, I think is something that's extremely important, because potential is not always potential for greatness, like the classic way of being a potential, but I think potential is also potential for autonomy, potential for freedom. The potential is for you to truly choose, you know, what you want to do and how you want to live. And I think answering that question is something that not a lot of people do. And so I encourage everyone listening to do that if you're thinking about that.
Fabulous. All right, let's do some rapid fire. First one, what is something that you absolutely really want to accomplish in the next 6 months?
The first thing that came to my head was getting to grad school, but I'm not going to say that. Release my debut album. So I'm actually working on an indie rock, indie pop album.
Cool.
And so that's coming out Christmas Day. And so, yeah, that's something I want to accomplish in the next 6 months.
Epic. Okay, love it. Now you're held accountable.
Yes.
What is a big thing? And we kind of touched on these, but anyway, whatever comes to mind first. What is the next big thing that not a lot of people are thinking about?
Yeah, so my head goes to biology first. I think the next big thing that not a lot of people are talking about is basically understanding the ties between the immune system and longevity, properly, fully appreciating that. I think that this is more of a pointed direction towards longevity, bio research based, where it's like we tend to look at biology from a very first principles basis. You know, aging is attributable to basically these sets of entropy, right? Like DNA breaking, entropy, reactive oxygen species, it's entropy. And I think a big thing that we're going to be looking at, especially now, is, you know, as a lot of like attempted aging therapies don't yield the most impressive results and tend to falter at like the efficaciousness phase, I think a lot of us are going to start looking at, okay, like what are the reactions to entropy that our body already has in place? How do we modulate those to increase the human health span? And I think what we're going to find is that basically what the people studying Alzheimer's have been looking for, what the people at the cutting edge of like even like autism research are studying, and what the people who really want to look at longevity research in a different way, I think all of these types of communities of researchers are going to kind of converge on a few set of ideas and core principles in the next few years that will basically inform how we can pursue age-related disease therapies in the future.
Fabulous. Yeah. And to add a little side note, I think entropy is one of the most important concepts, and I think it's super applicable in public health.
Yeah.
And that's what I've learned.
It's just applicable everywhere. Yeah.
Everything is entropy. Like, let's talk about, you know, laws of thermodynamics. They are fundamental. Laws of physics, all of it. Like, laws are good. Okay, who inspires you most right now?
I think, and I'm actually really happy to say this, I think it's the friends that I'm closest with right now. My core group of friends who I see almost every day, actually. They're the ones who inspire me the most. And these are, none of them are scientists, by the way. I'll preface by saying none of them are scientists and none of them are in STEM. These guys who are, like, some of them are like political science students, like one of them is like a record producer, the other one's like a videographer. These guys inspire me because they are living life on truly authentic themselves. And some of them have avoided a lot of things that like young people get like tempted by, because they just know their own values and know themselves so well that they just know, like, it's not something I want. And so they just avoid it. And they're comfortable with the fact of not having that, you know, not having those experiences or not trying these things. And that level of self-authenticity and discipline for that matter, I don't know, it's just beautiful to see. And I aspire to live life that authentically and to be that confident in oneself and in one's values and be that disciplined in life. I think it's pretty amazing to see. And they inspire me every day.
Amazing. I mean, I think that's beautiful. And I think you've mentioned your friends in such a natural way throughout this conversation. And I think that's just in your actions, such a testament to how, and I think you found like a really awesome group of people. So, I mean, I'm so happy.
That sounds like an amazing birthday. Birthday.
Thank you. I'm just quirky.
No,
I actually really love what you said about confidence. I've been thinking about confidence a lot recently. And because when we think about like a confident person, often we think about someone who's loud and assertive and says these things. But actually, I think confidence is in your ability to not talk, in your ability to say no to things. And I think confidence is like super complicated. And I think one of the most underrated elements of confidence, sorry, and I'm like going on a tangent, but I'll end here. Elements of confidence is just self-reliance. It's saying like, hey, I'm going to send you that email and like actually doing it. Because then it's like, gun to my head, if I was to say, hey, like, will Michael send me that email? And then I can be like, well, yeah, I'm confident that he will send me that email, right? Like it's like confidence is in your reliability for yourself and other people, and like that's how you build it. And once you have that, you don't have to perform. You don't have to do the acts that everyone else is doing, because you don't have to develop your authenticity through the behavior of others. And I think there's something really profound about that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's almost paradoxical. And oftentimes the way to get to that point is to be around, is to be influenced by the right people, because we're social creatures, and we're oftentimes, even though we say we're not mimetic, we are mimetic.
100%.
Mimetic biases. I don't know if you call something a bias if everyone does it, but until we can get to that point, I don't know. I'm still figuring out when that point is, and you fully know that you really want authenticity. But I actually think it's probably like a state rather than like something you just achieve. Like a state that you have to actively maintain, kind of like mindfulness. I think that level of authenticity is also a state that you have to like consistently like nourish and like work on it and maintain. There are very few things that are you've made it, and you know, you just do it once and you made it. Your muscle or something.
Totally. So switching gears, what is something you love but are bad at doing?
Something I love and I'm bad at doing. I think it's probably math.
Okay.
So I am not very good at doing math at all, actually. I'm okay at it, but I'm not that good at it at all, especially for like STEM standards. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest things that probably scared me away from doing full on engineering training, like in my undergrad. But I love it. I mean, the process of like coming up with like a logical proof or something is there's some beauty in that, like being able to like
derive
the principle, right? It's very rigorous. There's like a beauty in it too. I think math and arithmetic are definitely things that I love, but I'm definitely not that good at.
Yeah, amazing. What advice would you give to your 13-year-old self?
13-year-old me, I think kind of what we talked about: be around the right people who you look up to personally in terms of like their confidence in themselves and their supportiveness of you. And also just be compassionate to yourself and knowing that, you know, what you value and how you see the world is going to change, and just be along for the ride, embrace the change, and be willing to do what you got to do to let yourself grow, and be as kind as you can and be as empathetic as you can in the process.
Beautiful. And one last question. What is something that everyone should experience at least once in their lifetime?
Ooh, that's a good one. What is one thing that everyone should experience at least once in their lifetime? I'd say it's the absurd. The absurd is a concept from Camus that he describes. Mm-hmm. Like Camus. And it's basically this feeling of like absolute astonishment, almost like terrifying level astonishment at something. It can be like the first time you see a mountain. It can be the feeling you get jumping out of an airplane. It can be the feeling you get when you see a cell divide for the first time. It can be something huge or something small, but there's this moment where you're almost like detached from your ego or from your emotional stuff, and you're just like marveled at something. I think the absurd, like that in that sense, is something that everyone should experience, because it puts into perspective how big everything is in comparison to, you know, our everyday thoughts and our everyday worries. And it's also beautiful. It's like a true testament to how beautiful life is. So yeah, experience the absurd in your own way.
Fantastic way to end the podcast. Thank you so much, Michael, for being here. I hope everyone enjoyed. I'm personally, my brain is firing. So many new ways of thinking about cancer. So many new ways of appreciating the marvels of life, as you put it. So thanks so much for being on the episode. Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.